Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori on this Saturday morning. How are we doing this morning? So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning right here on WLIW 88.3 FM Southampton, serving Eastern Long Island and Southern Connecticut, 96.9 in Western Suffolk, and streaming at WLIW.org/radio and on your favorite streaming platforms. And each show is archived on my website at annliguori.com and distributed on my podcast via Audioboom and iTunes. This morning, I will share a conversation I had with two extraordinary teenage golfers who happen to be sisters, Amelie and Alexa Fung. Amelie is 17 years old, and she is a freshman at Rice University. Alexa is 14 and going to high school in Florida. They both grew up in Forest Hills in Queens, New York. And at very early ages, they've compiled tons of golf wins, and they excel on and off the course. I met them both at Augusta National during the National Drive, Chip, and Putt Finals. Alexa won that event in actually two different age categories. And in addition to golf, they excel in the classroom, and they both excel in chess, winning national competitions. And we will hear how the game of chess actually helps them in golf. Certainly does. They are just such impressive sisters. And Steve Flink, whom I've known in the tennis world for decades, he's a Hall of Fame tennis journalist. I'll discuss rivalries in the sport of tennis, mostly about the big three: Roger Federer, Rafael Nadal, and Novak Djokovic. Who is the very best of those three? How do they compare against each other? Novak Djokovic owns more major titles, 24, than any other guy in tennis history. At age of 38, Djokovic is still going strong. It's just amazing. You know, I've been watching and working on the U.S. Open, at the U.S. Open, for 43 years in a variety of capacities. And I started, boy, in 1982 as a statistician for HBO Sports, who had the rights, the cable rights at that time. And my job was to give the Chiron operator the score. So I sat in the Chiron booth, this dark booth, for two straight weeks watching every match that was on, that they played on HBO. And if I got the score wrong, the national audience got the score wrong. So for a kid right out of college, it really was a lot of pressure. But I knew tennis, and Michael Whalen, who actually became the programmer, just historic programmer, who started the Golf Channel in the programming department, and actually later hired me to host Conversations with Ann Liguori, a weekly primetime show that aired on the Golf Channel for 5 years. It actually was the first primetime show on the Golf Channel hosted by a woman. Michael Whalen was working at HBO back then and hired me to be the scorekeeper for the Chiron operator. And it's amazing how life just evolves, and the contacts you make continue to evolve, and Michael and I have remained close all these years later. And then I started working for ABC Radio Sports Network, and I was first a producer for them, freelance producer, and then I became a reporter covering every team in New York, all the major events in New York, press conferences at the 21 Club, at the Plaza, various boxing press conferences, and they used to have press conference lunches for every sport, whether it was track and field, the Melrose Games, or boxing, or WTA tennis at the Garden, Virginia Slims. Or I used to cover everything that was happening in New York City, not only for ABC Radio Sports as a freelance producer and reporter, but also as a correspondent for USA Today, for the sports pages of USA Today. So I would go to these press conferences and various games, whether it was the Mets, the Yankees, the Jets, the Giants, the NBA teams, Knicks, Nets, hockey. And I would either send back interviews with the key players to ABC Radio Sports and or write up articles for the sports talk section of USA Today. So it was just incredible, you know, as a freelance journalist and reporter back in the day, to have all these different jobs. Hey, I was just trying to pay the rent, the expensive rent in New York City, as a young producer reporter in New York, pursuing my career in sports journalism. And those experiences were incredible because I got to meet so many people, not only the athletes from all these teams and tennis and golf, et cetera, but sponsors, various marketing people and executives who came in as sponsors of these major events. And eventually, you know, I would bring in my own sponsors for my radio shows and The Fan and my TV shows, Sports Interview Show, the show that aired on cable networks for 17 years. I brought in all my own sponsors for that show every week. So it was a really great experience. But getting back to the U.S. Open, after doing reports at ABC for ABC Radio Sports Network, I also started right away with updates on WFAN when WFAN first started in 1987. So my work at the U.S. Open through these last 43 years has really evolved, and I've seen some of the most incredible matches at the U.S. Open, you know, not only on the Arthur Ashe Stadium court, but throughout all the courses, really. Roger Federer winning five straight U.S. Open titles from 2004 to 2008. Before that, seeing Andre Agassi grow up through the years, playing the Open and winning in 94 and 99. Steffi Graf winning five U.S. Open titles between 88 and 1996. Before that, even Jimmy Connors on his 39th birthday. I was there when he beat Aaron Krikstein in that epic five-set battle in the fourth round of the 1991 U.S. Open. So many great battles, so many great memories. Serena Williams winning six U.S. Open titles. Novak Djokovic and Rafael Nadal winning four U.S. Open titles. In fact, Nadal's U.S. Open title in 2010 at the age of 24, he became the youngest man to achieve the career Grand Slam. So many great memories, so many great matches. And this morning, we will talk about those big three that won 66 major titles among them. Roger Federer, Rafael Nadal, Novak Djokovic, still going strong, Novak. So Hall of Fame tennis journalist Steve Flink will be one of my guests this morning. Hope you enjoyed this edition of Sports Interview with Anne Liguori. My next guest are two of the most extraordinary sisters in golf. Extraordinary sisters with mega accomplishments on and off the golf course. So impressive are these girls that I wanted to introduce them to you now, because you will be hearing about both of them more and more in the future. And you probably have already heard of them. Amelie Fong is 17 years old. Her younger sister, Alexa, is 14. They both grew up in Forest Hills, New York, and they go to school and train in Boca Raton, Florida, during the school year. And Amelie will be attending Rice University this fall and will be playing golf for them. And she is a National Merit Scholarship finalist. She won an LPGA scholarship, Palm Beach County Girls Golf First Team, Rolex Scholarship, Junior All-American. She is an ambassador with the Annika Foundation. Again, I could go on and on about Amelie. Alexa, 14 years old. I remember watching Alexa compete in the Drive, Chip, and Putt National Finals at Augusta National. She won the girls' 12 to 13 division this year, and in 2023, won the girls' 10 to 11 category. She's a four-time finalist. Alexa holds about, seven records in golf in the state of Florida for her age. Again, I could go on and on and on, but let's go right to the girls. Welcome to Talking Golf, Amelie and Alexa. Glad you can be on the show.
Thank you so much for inviting us. It's an honor to be on here with you, Anne.
Oh, thank you so much. Take us back to the beginning, Amelie. When did you girls start playing golf, and who did you learn from?
Well, I started golf at a pitch and putt area just in Flushing, Queens. My dad taught me. He wanted to get me started in a sport, and he really enjoyed golf growing up, so he wanted Well, he learned a little later in life than I did, but he felt like there were a lot of lessons to be learned through this sport. So he wanted to kind of take his kids through it. And so he started me there, and I kind of just, the passion kind of grew as I got older. He put me in tournaments, and it just kept going on and on. And then Alexa came on, and when she came, it just became us together, always together, practicing, playing tournaments together. And that definitely made the golf experiences more special.
So, how old were you, Amelie, when you started?
I started when I was 7.
And how old was Alexa?
I started when around 5, 6 years old.
And did your dad teach you as well in the early going?
Yes, between my dad and my sister.
Oh, I love it. All right. So, then when did you connect with other coaches to further learn the sport?
I'd say about a year or two in, I feel like one thing that my dad was great about is he was very self-aware. He knew he was a good golfer, like he got close to scratch in his prime, but he knew that he didn't know the technicals as well as a coach did. So he wanted to make sure that we were learning along the right path. So I'd say about a year or two in, he connected me with a great coach in Sleepy Hollow, Kevin Sprecher. And then from there, we bounced around to different coaches. I mean, Kevin was a great coach, but he was a little far out. And then we worked sometimes with some people at Ledbetter, and it's just kind of moved around.
So you've had a lot of influences as far as coaching goes.
Definitely. They're all very helpful in their own way, and I feel like they have specialties that we definitely take in our games that we wouldn't be able to learn from just one coach.
Correct. And did Alexa do the same thing, learn from a variety of coaches in the Met section?
Yes, that's right. I pretty much just followed Amelie wherever she went, and it was honestly, I felt like it was a great learning experience working with different coaches because, I mean, everyone has their own view in on golf, on the sport, this crazy sport that involves so many different factors, and I felt like it was great for both Amelie and I.
Yeah, you don't want too much information up there, right? Because you want your natural talent to take over. You don't want to think too much. So I guess it's great to get the fundamentals from a variety of coaches. And then what do you do? Kind of weed out some of the information that may not apply to your own swing, or did you basically use everything you learned from all these different coaches?
I definitely think it's hard to keep track of everything we learn from each lesson. I know we both try to write it down, keep it in the back of our mind, but it always comes down to fundamentals with me at least, probably similar to Alexa, tempo, alignment, just keeping those things intact and just remembering the different inputs that different coaches kind of recommended for each one as a guideline.
And you're both really great students. So I assume that being, very good students, you were able to pick up these fundamentals and remember them, and you love to learn. And so, as you say, the fundamentals are so important. I always advise young people to take lessons and learn the correct swing so that you can practice correctly, right?
Definitely, definitely.
So, did you both play other sports when you were growing up? Well, you're still growing up. Alexa is. Amelie's a young woman now, but I keep forgetting how young you are. Alexa, you're 14. So did you play other sports, Alexa?
Personally, if you will count it as a sport, both Amelie and I, we both played competitive chess. And so I would say from the ripe age, around the time that I started golf, between the age of like 4 to 5 is when I picked up competitive chess. And just like with golf, I kind of came along to these chess tournaments and it was just a really fun experience. And I feel like competitive chess, it requires you to sit at a table in front of your opponents and you're just going at it for sometimes up to 2 to 4 hours. And so I felt like that really mentally trained me for golf tournaments and for just being under pressure.
What incredible training for golf. It's such a mental sport, golf and chess. I want you to talk a little bit about that. First of all, who exposed you to chess?
Our father did.
Definitely our father.
Yeah.
Oh, so he plays.
Yes, he did.
Okay. And I know you both have won tournaments in chess, right?
Yes, we have.
Tell me, you can brag about yourself. Tell me how far you've gotten along in the world of chess.
Sure. So, personally, I've won the US chess team a silver medal in Mexico. And I also, I believe it was for the girls' eights, I won a national championship in Chicago. And I've also been a part of the FAU High and starting up the FAU High school team chess team, and we also brought home a trophy, I believe in 2021. And so overall, it's and I mean all over New York, we traveled to many different high schools, and I've traveled obviously with my sister because she would be a part of these tournaments too in different age categories. And so overall, it was really fun, and I felt like we kind of knew that at one point we would have to choose between chess and golf, and ultimately we decided golf.
As Alexa mentioned, there's a lot of focus required for both sports. With chess, you're sitting down, you're idle, so it doesn't seem like it would be similar to golf where you're constantly walking, but you're always in your mind with both sports. I mean, in golf, you're maybe hitting the ball for a couple minutes out of the entire round, but then you're walking, you're thinking about your next shot, you're in your own mind about what's to come, about what happened in the past. In a similar way with chess, you have to kind of brush off mistakes and don't let anything show in your face so that your opponent doesn't know. I just remember that it was definitely huge if you could maintain your focus, if you cannot let what your opponent was doing or don't let it get in your head and just always be one step ahead. Like being proactive, that's huge for golf and chess, knowing how to think ahead and plan for the next day, prepare for the next tournament, hole location, stuff like that.
Do you agree with all that, Alexa? The training that chess provides for the mental aspect of golf?
100%, definitely. I would say, I mean, every night after like tournaments, I would always go over my holes. I'd tell Amelie, "Oh, I did horribly on this hole," or "Oh man, this birdie was great." And then I feel like also in chess, like we would go over our rounds, and Amelie would point out, "Oh, you had a huge blunder here, Amelie, Alexa," and so it was really fun. And I feel like it was just overall the two sports, I like to call them, they're very similar mentally.
I'm sure. Well, what great training. And the fact that you both excel in both is just extraordinary. Now, I know you both played in the New York State 18 and under championship, and Amelie beat her younger sister, Alexa, in the final round on the first playoff hole. Talk about that, Amelie. Was it difficult to beat your sis, your younger sis?
I would definitely say she was putting up a great fight. So we played 36 holes the second round, and we were together. Me and the third player was a friend of mine, so it was a very comfortable round. My brother was caddying Alexa, and I had another caddy from the club. So I was getting, we were both playing very well. She had a bogey-free 9 under between the two rounds, and I think I stayed steady. I was 6 under. And I don't know, it just kind of worked out in my favor, I guess, in the playoff hole. We both ended up in the left bunker. And it's funny, when I played, so we replayed hole 18, and just the hole before we played 18 coming in, and I got in the same bunker and I bogeyed and she parred. So I messed up from the bunker in the hole before. So when we replayed it, I got back in the same bunker and I kind of wanted to avenge myself a little bit. So I got it pretty close, I'd say within 2, 3 feet, and was able to tap it in. And it just kind of went from there. But it was really special to experience that with her. It's, being a sister pair that was able to both show up and just play some good rounds together was really special. So it was really, really like coincidental that we would get in a playoff together, that we would be able to play this round together. And I practice with her all the time, so it's like I know how she plays, I know how clutch she is, I know how good she is. So it was even more fun to be able to experience her in tournament play when she's like a different person, because she's so focused during tournaments. It was funny, I was like a different person next to me.
Alexa, how has your sister helped you develop your game?
I mean, she's just over the years, she's definitely coached me. She's gone through it for the first time. She was the first one in this junior golf, in this crazy world of junior golf. And I mean, I feel like
She's really helped me grow as a person and also on a golf course by like telling me, oh, like don't get in your head too much. Because I mean, every person on a golf course, they know when they have a bad hole, it can get in your head and everything. And in this past tournament, it was definitely, I used some of her coaching where it was a very tight last 18 holes, and it was really anyone's tournament. And so I really tried to stay focused and try to keep the pressure somewhere else in the back of my head with her coaching advice last night, where she said, it's not really, it's not, this tournament is not like something, it's, there's very little pressure because it's not a tournament where you're supposed to win, and you're just going out there to have fun and really just take in this experience playing with other such great players.
And you just won this tournament literally minutes before we're recording this interview, an AJGA Junior Open in Delaware for ages 12 to 18, and you're only 14. So you beat girls a lot older than you.
Right, but it was a great tournament, and I couldn't be happier with the results.
Congratulations to both of you. I'm just so impressed with your success, again, on and off the course. But what else is golf taught you, Amelie?
I would say golf has taught me that, you know, life is unfair, that you're going to get some unlucky bounces, and you just have to learn how to process them. You can only really control yourself out there. And I think that that's definitely something that's been really helpful for non-golf. You know, when you go in and you've got teammates or people you're working with in a group project, and it just seems like the world's against you. And it's nothing personal, that's just how life is. But learning how to just, okay, well, if I can be my best self, I can step up, I can make sure that we all rise above.
That is such a great answer. How about you, Alexa? What has golf taught you at your young age?
I would say golf has taught me patience. For example, like just a few hours ago when I was on a golf course, I did not have the strongest start, or I'm sorry, my other competitors in my group, they had a very strong start, and right off the bat, I was under, and so I had to just wait it out and play the long game. And I mean, that's how kind of golf is. When you try and force a birdie or an eagle, very rarely do they actually happen. And so I feel like golf has really taught me that you just have to wait and let it happen on its own. And you can't try and force anything and be too impatient.
Welcome back to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori, and it is my pleasure to say hello to Steve Flink, Hall of Famer Steve Flink, who is just a veteran tennis journalist, formerly of World Tennis, author of several books, and also writes, contributes to the U.S. Open Daily. And boy, Steve Flink, you've been around for a long time.
Some people are delighted about that. Maybe others aren't. No, I've been very fortunate, you know, to have been writing about tennis for more than 50 years and have been around it so long. And of course, through much of that period, you've been there with me.
That's right. Gosh, 43 for me, Steve Flink. And we're sitting in the broadcast booth here overlooking the Arthur Ashe Stadium court at the Billie Jean King National Tennis Center. And I can remember when, you know, this was just the National Tennis Center before Billie Jean King even got the recognition she deserved.
Well, they moved over here, and as I know you remember, in 1978, they've been at Forest Hills through 77. Big switch because Forest Hills had switched from grass to clay. Then they came here to the hard courts where they've been ever since. And you're right, it was just Louis Armstrong Stadium was the main stadium. There was no such thing as Arthur Ashe Stadium. That didn't come until 97. Nearly 20 years. So the evolution of this place is pretty remarkable.
I remember the Louis Armstrong press box. That place was an adventure in itself, just getting up there if the elevators worked. And it was so small, and everybody was crammed in there. And the journalists, a lot of journalists were smoking. And, you know, I was handwriting my radio scripts for WFAN back then.
And you also probably remember, too, I mean, that was largely the result, in my understanding, the PR guy at the time had worked at Penn Football, Ed Fabricius, who was a great guy. And Ed, I think, honestly thought because of the football and college football, that's where you'd locate the press room and they'd do their writing up there. But he didn't realize that for tennis, that was not ideal. That was not the ideal spot. And so the press, a lot of times they're up there working. There was a press section down below, but that was quite a hike to get to the top of the. Either you hiked it on foot or you went in the elevator, which was rather shaky.
And I understand they're going to be doing some improvements here in the Ash Stadium court in the fall, putting a lot of money into it, restoring some of or renovating some of the VIP suites. And they're going to put a couple more elevators to get up here to the broadcast booths up here overlooking the Ash court. So they're always thinking of things, Steve, and expanding the schedule, the mixed doubles, the first, you know, during qualifier week, and just so many innovations to you, and you've been here for so many years. What has been the most meaningful innovation, in your opinion, here at this National Tennis Center?
Well, I think we alluded to it. I mean, I think this move, building the big Arthur Ashe Stadium, which was a step up. There was nothing wrong with Armstrong. Armstrong had its own electric atmosphere, but it didn't match what was produced here in Ashe Stadium. And then the next thing was when finally they put up the roof, and then they later put up a roof over Armstrong as well. But I remember Federer and Djokovic had played a final in 2015, delayed by 3 hours because it started to rain about 10 minutes before the match. Beautiful day up until then. 3-hour delay. Luckily, by the next year, we had the roof and no longer had to experience anything like that. So I'd say, number one, just the emergence, the building of Ashe Stadium. Secondly, the roof, which they really needed very badly.
You know, it's interesting you said that, because the guys who operate the roof and, you know, all the engineers are in the booth next to this booth here, and they have the roof up now, but it looks beautiful outside. So I'm wondering what the deal is if they're predicting rain for tonight.
You would think so. I can't think of any other reason why. You're right. We can see the skyline. There's some clouds, but there's a lot of blue sky out there as well. So no telling what the reasoning is.
But you're absolutely right. What an innovation, and it's really kept things much more on schedule when they're able to put this roof up. Let's talk, though, about one of my favorite subjects in tennis, and that is rivalries. That is, you know, the big three for so many years that, you know, that we were covering this sport, Federer and Nadal and Djokovic, and how wonderful it is that Novak Djokovic, at the age of 38, is still playing and still going strong.
Yeah, I mean, it's remarkable that people talk about his so-called decline. He's been in three straight Grand Slam semifinals this year, and he's back in the quarters playing Taylor Fritz tonight, try to get to a fourth in a row at 38. But you're right, to get to the rivalries, they're the lifeblood of the sport. That's what the fans want. You think of some of the great rivalries in the past, Sampras and Agassi, Everett and Navratilova, Graf and Sellis. This is what really the spectators find most compelling. And that trio that you started off with there, Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, there's been nothing like that, to have the cross rivalries. You know, it started, of course, with Roger and Rafa was the first big rivalry among that trio. And they played three straight French Open finals, and the same years played in the Wimbledon finals. 2006 to 2008, we're talking about. 3 years in a row, they're playing the French and Wimbledon finals against each other. And then, of course, Djokovic was a little behind them, and he trailed both of them significantly in their personal rivalries. But then he came to the forefront, particularly starting in 2011. And so he built quite a rivalry with both Roger and Rafa himself. So we were spoiled. We have been spoiled because Novak is the only member of the iconic trio who remains. Fans appreciate him more than ever now, but he was what he did in those, and he came out on top, by the way, head to head against both Rafa and Roger. He was 27-23 against Roger and 31 wins, 29 losses against Rafa, coming from far back in each of those series. So it's just a spectacular era.
It really was. How fortunate we are, as you mentioned, to have experienced that, to see those rivalries. Roger Federer versus Rafael Nadal. When I looked at that head-to-head, Steve Flink, Federer had 16 wins to Nadal's 24 wins, which, you know, yeah, Nadal won the majority, you know, more of those matches. But I also see that Nadal won five major titles against Federer. So part
yeah,
of
it was six. It was actually was six. Yeah, but the thing is, Anne, what's interesting, you mentioned 24-16, is that Roger surprisingly won six of the last seven against Rafa. It was much more one-sided. It looked better in the end for Roger because he made some inroads toward the end, including a big semifinal win over Rafa in the semifinals of Wimbledon in 2019 before he lost an epic to Novak, where he had two match points before going down in a fifth set tiebreak. So, yeah, the Federer-Nadal rivalry was enhanced in a way by that resurgence from Federer at the end, which included a big win over Rafa at the 2017 Australian Open in the final, where he came from 3-1 down in the fifth. Just so many. We could sit here, Anne, for 2.5 hours, and we would just be scratching the surface.
Right, absolutely, because it started in 2004, their rivalry, yes. And culminated in 2019. Right. That is an incredible amount of time.
Yeah, no, it is. And, you know, Rafa had that win over Roger in 2004, and then their first major meeting was 2005 at the French. So those went on. I mean, they were meeting at the majors from 2005 all the way up to 2019. And not much different when you look at the Rafa-Novak rivalry or the Novak-Roger rivalry. I will say this, Anne, my personal taste was different from most. Most people would say Nadal-Federer was the most intriguing. There was more contrast. This left-handed Spaniard who hitting those punishing ground strokes with his heavy topspin against Roger, who was such a classic attacking player and the most elegant player of the trio. And so you had a nice contrast in their methodology, not so much when you had Djokovic playing Nadal. But to me, the most fun for some reason, for many reasons, was Djokovic playing Federer. I just really enjoyed it. They played so many big matches in the latter stages of Roger's career, and when Novak was peaking, they played the finals of Wimbledon in 2014, 2015, again in 2019. They played here in 2015. And there was something about the undercurrent of those matches. They weren't necessarily that fond of each other, but they were very respectful. But they just would go all out in these fierce, big hitting exchanges from the baseline. I enjoyed those matches every bit as much, if not more, than Nadal versus Federer.
Yeah, just one quick thing before we move on to Djokovic and Federer. Federer versus Nadal, is it true they never met at the U.S. Open?
Absolutely true. Yeah, that was the one disappointment, and they came so close. So close in 2008. I could give you countless examples, but 2008, Rafa surprisingly lost to Murray in the semis, who then lost to Federer. And then the closest they came was both 2010 and 2011, when each of those years, Novak recovered from double match point down to beat Federer. So Federer was, that's how close they were to meeting, because Nadal was in the finals of both of those events. So they would have played those years. And even 2013, when Roger suffered a shocking loss in one of his worst years to Tommy Robredo of Spain, they would have actually met that year in the quarter. So they both were in the fourth round. So many close calls. And what a shame they couldn't have rounded it out by playing here, because Novak and Roger, they met in all four majors, and so did Novak and Rafa. But strangely, Federer and Nadal, it just didn't happen here. And what a shame for the fans that they didn't get to see it in New York.
Right. It's just amazing to me, all those years that they played and they never met at a U.S. Open, and they were one match away from meeting, six different times. Just extraordinary. So you think the most compelling matchup in those rivalries was Djokovic against Federer?
That's my personal preference, because I just remember those matches. That Wimbledon final to me was one of my favorite matches ever, because Federer served for the match at 8-7 in the fifth, double match point on his serve. Djokovic recovered. They went to 12-all. They were playing the tiebreak at 12-all that year, and Djokovic wins in a tiebreak. But listen, I still say the best match I ever saw, I haven't changed my mind on that, was Nadal beating Federer in the 2008 Wimbledon final, which he won 9-7 in the fifth on the edge of darkness. They didn't have five more minutes left to play. It was about 9:16 in the evening when it ended. So we're talking about narrow margins here, because all three rivalries had so much to offer.
Maybe that is one reason, Federer versus Djokovic. Federer was so likable, and particularly here at the U.S. Open, people loved him here in New York.
No, wait, Ann, I'm going to stop you there. They loved him everywhere he went and at every stage of his career, wherever he went. I have to say, you're right. He was beloved here. Don't get me wrong. It's just I couldn't get over how whatever stadium I walked into in the world, and what it didn't matter whether it was the young Roger, the dominant Roger, or the Roger in the autumn of his career, it didn't make any difference. They absolutely supported him. I think a lot of it had to do with how he played. He comported himself very well, too. We know that. He was a sportsman, but not that the other two weren't. But I think it was more than anything the elegance of his game, the beauty of his game. That's what made the spectators flock to him and always want to cheer for him.
Sure. Just effortless, just, you know, a ballet style, beautiful, you know, just movement. His movement was so graceful and beautiful. But I do believe because of his popularity, it almost became a nemesis for Novak Djokovic because it took a long time for people to appreciate Novak Djokovic's greatness, even when he was winning and beating these top players.
No doubt about it. But it wasn't just about Roger. It was about Rafa, too, because the Roger fans were kind of okay. If he was going to lose to anybody, they'd pick Rafa. They'd say, okay, I can accept that. And vice versa, same deal. But for some reason, that generosity of spirit was not extended to Djokovic. Maybe because he was just more out front and outspoken and clear about his goals, and he wasn't disrespectful toward them, but he made it clear that his goal was to achieve more than anybody, and he didn't want anybody getting in his way. There was a directness about him and how he conducted himself. Plus, he was more human. You know, there's sometimes when he'd smash rackets, things would happen to him. While Roger and Rafa were almost always impeccably behaved, Novak was more human, but he also brought so many great qualities to the arena. But people, they were slow to accept him. You and I were talking about this earlier down below, Anne, watching one of the matches, and I do believe that right now, because he's the last member of the trio left, that there is an appreciation of him that was never there before, because they understand, first of all, he's not competing against their heroes anymore, and secondly, they realize what it took for him to surpass both of those guys numerically, and he did.
Oh, absolutely. With 24 major singles titles to Rafael Nadal, who finished with 22, Roger Federer with 20. I always thought it would be Roger, five-time U.S. Open champion, who would have more singles titles than any other player, but it came out to be Novak Djokovic.
Exactly. Keep in mind, and you were at one stage, you were right. He's the man who at 2009 Wimbledon, when he beat Andy Roddick in the final, moved ahead of Pete Sampras, and that had seemed at one time inconceivable, Pete's 14. Roger got to 15 then. And then he kept his lead for quite a few years after that. And it didn't seem like, for a long time, it didn't seem like either Rafa or Novak could catch him. But they both surpassed him. That's the remarkable thing. Not just Novak, but the fact that Rafa also surpassed him. So, it was just an exhilarating era in that sense. And they drove each other on. Let's face it. They all inspired each other. And there was a battle to improve. They wanted to improve their games. They wanted to improve their numbers. And so what that took constantly going through each other was remarkable.
And surprising that Roger retired before Rafael Nadal.
Yeah, it's true. But, of course, 5-6 years older, I mean, and his knees were giving out on him by then. So in some ways he didn't have a choice, which was too bad. Well, Rafa and Novak are only about a year apart in age. And actually, the most surprising thing to me was that Rafa managed to somehow keep playing through last year because he had the biggest multitude of injuries of all three of those guys, and somehow he kept coming back from countless different injuries. Originally it was the knees, and he had a serious issue with his foot, and then it was everything under the sun, but somehow he had the resilience to keep returning to the arena. And he had the most injuries. Roger had what ended up being chronic knee troubles, and right. Novak of the three has probably been the most fortunate, but he's also put in incredibly hard work to stay as healthy and to stay away from too many serious injuries, you know, and he's done well with that.
And Novak Djokovic, give him credit. You said, you know, he's always been very opinionated, very direct. He did not want to get vaccinated. He didn't believe in it. He stuck to his guns to the detriment of perhaps winning a couple more major titles.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question, and it's true that when this was all coming out, when it was getting to the point where all the players on the tour, depending on what country they were going to, during COVID, they had to have that vaccine. Novak understood that up front and realized he might pay a price for his stand. So the biggest case was the 2022 Australian Open when he actually flew over there, and then it just turned into a mess because the government told him, you know, he couldn't play. There was an appeal, and originally it was going his way. Then it was rescinded, and eventually had to go home. And then he missed a U.S. Open here too. You know, would he have won two or three more? We'll never know, because I also think, would he have necessarily won three majors in 2023 had he already won a couple more before that? If he'd been in a better shape with his numbers, maybe the incentive, the motivation wouldn't have been quite as great. So I think the 2023 season was really commendable on his part, what he did after all that stuff with COVID and missing majors and not being able to play here, not being able to play Australia 1 year, to win three of the four that year and winning here at the U.S. Open, oldest champion ever at 36, 2 years ago. I think that will go down maybe as perhaps his most satisfying year.
Sure. And he has a chance to do it again. He's 38. It would be wonderful for him to get to 25 all-time Grand Slam singles titles. Is that significant in your opinion?
Yes and no. It's a nice round number. It would separate him from all tennis players, men and women. But to me, the big battle again is it's men versus men, women versus women. Margaret has the record for women, all credit to her, although she got what I think were some cheap Australian Opens when the fields were not very strong there in the 60s. But nonetheless, still great achievement. But Novak worked so hard to move past both Rafa and Roger, first Roger, then Rafa, getting past them both, getting to his 24. That to me that's much more meaningful, and it would be like icing on the cake. It would be very gratifying to win a major at 38, and you're so right. But does he need it? No, I think he really did need that 23rd and 24th. That was what mattered to him more than anything, was to surpass his greatest rivals and surpass all of the men in the history of the game.
Absolutely. What an achievement. So looking back at those three, would you say, based on Djokovic's numbers, he would be the all-time great of all those three, based on his career wins and major titles?
Yes, I mean, I think that's the prevailing view. That's certainly my view, because you start with the slams. So he beat them in the slams. Then you look at their head-to-heads. He's winning record against both. Then you look at the Masters 1000s, which are the next most important. He's got 40 of those, more than Roger or Rafa. Then you look at weeks at number one, far more than either one, 428, and he also finished 8 years at number one. They didn't. They had five each. So I look at all that. I see so many crucial statistical errors. Now, some people would want to argue, and some Federer fans would argue, that his best tennis was better than either of those guys. I think that's open to question. You could make the case that Roger, primetime Roger of 2004 to 2007, was better than Novak at any stage, or better than Rafa, but neither one of them. Rafa was already starting to peak on clay, but only on clay in that period, and Novak had not peaked anywhere yet. So I don't think so. I think you have to really look at it more statistically, and they all had great technical qualities, but that statistically he clearly surpassed them. And I don't think either Roger or Rafa would argue with that.
Right, and he's still going strong. Novak Djokovic at 38. Now let's look at him versus Jannik Sinner. He's only 24. Jannik beating Djokovic, what, the last four times they play, I believe. And Sinner has that head-to-head, is winning that head-to-head at this point.
Yeah, he's giving away too many years to Sinner and Alcaraz. He's actually up 5-3 against Carlos, which is remarkable. Carlos is 16 years younger. Jannik is 14 years younger. And people used to make a very big deal out of Roger being 5-6 years older than 5 years older than Rafa, or, you know, 5-6 year age gap with Rafa and Novak, and they thought that was sort of unfair. It was a real disadvantage for him, and not well. This is three times as long a span. So Sinner is obviously started to peak in these last few years, and also he plays more like Novak than Carlos does. Carlos is more adventuresome, so. those have been trickier matches for Novak. He was able to beat Yannick most of the time through the end of 2023. Since then, you know, he has not. But it's understandable given the age disparity and given the playing style that Sinner is in some ways not quite a mirror image, but close enough with the way he plays the game. So he's giving nothing away, and maybe he's a little bit faster at this stage. And so it makes sense. Well, Carlos, more audacious, more of a risk taker. So Novak on certain days has out-dueled him, including for the Olympic gold medal was his most impressive win over Carlos. Two tiebreakers last summer at Roland Garros in the final. So, and again, that's the last piece we didn't even talk about is, yes, Rafa won the Olympic singles. Roger never did. But Novak was able to add that, so he had everything else, including all those year-end championships. But he also beat Carlos remarkably in the quarters of the Australian this year. So he's continued to do better against Carlos in the last year and a half, than he has against Yannick. But who knows? Maybe he's got one more big win left in him against Yannick. I don't put it past him on a given day to beat Sinner. He's just not going to beat him the majority of the time anymore.
All right, so I know it's a bit of an intangible because the other guys, you know, but at their prime, putting Sinner in the mix, putting Alcaraz in the mix, Roger, Rafael, Djokovic, who would you say is the best player in their prime?
Well, yeah, that's what I was sort of getting at there, that some would argue that was Roger. I wouldn't. I think there's no clear choice there. That's why I say you have to look at the numbers. And we're never going to be able to properly compare Novak or the other two, obviously, to Sinner and Alcaraz. There's a little crossover era going on right now. The fans are being treated to these what are going to be briefer rivalries between Djokovic and Alcaraz, Djokovic and Sinner. But the long-term rivalry would be Alcaraz and Sinner. So I don't know. I would just say this. Alcaraz resembles Federer more in the sense of this sort of natural flowing talent, all-around ability, that on given days he's just unstoppable and is an immovable force. He's just got too many shots, and if they're all clicking and he's on, you could argue that nobody could beat him. But I think we have to judge these guys, you know, on the entirety of their work. And the other guy that I would throw into this, by the way, that I do believe that on courts like these and at Wimbledon would challenge any of these people and hold his own is Pete Sampras, because he had the greatest serve we've ever seen, and he had one of the great match-playing temperaments as well, very unshakable on the court. So I would put him very much in that conversation.
And of all those guys you mentioned, all the greats, who was the most mentally tough, would you say?
I'd say Djokovic. Sampras close, but I think that's what's actually separated Novak from, and Rafa is close behind too. And I would put both of them over Roger, which is no knock on Roger because he's been very remarkably mentally tough in his own way too. But Djokovic has recorded more clutch wins, and including the two here that I mentioned in the semis against Roger, both from double match point down in 2010, 2011, the Wimbledon final saving two match points in 2019. And then a couple of clutch wins over Rafa at the 2012 Australian final, which 5 hours and 53-minute match, and he came from a breakdown in the fifth, and a Wimbledon 10-8 in the fifth semi. Just so many of those matches that were hanging in the balance, he somehow found a way to win. So that's why I'd have to put him down as the greatest competitor.
Switching over to the women. And it was great to see the homage, the tribute they paid to Chrissy Everett in her 50th anniversary since winning, right, the U.S. What was it back then, the U.S. Open, or was it the U.S.? It was U.S. Right. Open back then. Jeez, I can't believe it was 50. It's been 50 years. Yeah. But what are your thoughts about rivalries in the women's game?
Her rivalry with Martina stretched from 73 to 88, 80 matches, 43 for Martina wins and 37 for Chrissy. Chrissy early on dominating Martina, 20-4, big lead. Martina comes roaring back and starts dominating one stage, 113 in a row, but then Chrissy at the end started holding her own again. Fantastic rivalry. What made that one so special was the complete contrast in styles. Although Chrissy did improve her net game a lot and started to come in more in the latter stages of her career, primarily known for counterattacking, her great two-handed backhand, the passing shots, Martina serving and volleying all the time. Left-hander versus right-hander, it had it all. And so I think that was the premier, frankly, that was the premier rivalry I think I've ever seen in tennis, period, even more so than the great ones we're just discussing. I wouldn't put it by a wide margin, but I would rate it over those for a variety of reasons. Another one would be Graf and Selis, too short. Yeah. Too short, but the matches that they played in this period before, both before and after Monica was stabbed in the back in Germany in the 90s were fantastic. They had an epic French Open final in 92, 10-8 in the third to Monica, and just some, and a great one here in 95 after Monica came back. The problem with that one is it didn't last long enough because Monica didn't stay quite at that level after her return. And the Williams sisters, you'd put it up there. The problem with that one is I think people, they appreciated the incredible athleticism, the speed and the power of both players, but there was a sameness to it. They weren't identical, but they were so close that the tennis itself was not necessarily as enjoyable as it's been in some of these other rivalries. I mean, you got to salute them because at one stage they played in 5 out of 6 major finals, a couple in a row. I mean, every major, they're meeting the finals of every major too. But were the contests as enjoyable as some of the others? I don't think so. It takes nothing away from them and their gifts and their talent. But from a spectator standpoint, they weren't quite as much fun.
Right. But watching Martina Navratilova all those years and Chrissy Everett, they both brought such a different game to the court. And to see them all these years later, you know, they both overcame health issues, you know, yeah. Very severe health issues. Yeah. They're both broadcasting here at the Open and around at all the other major championships. It's a joy. It's been a joy to really follow their careers, I'm sure, for you as well, Steve.
Oh, it absolutely has. And they have represented the game so impeccably, both of them, and the respect they have for each other. There was some strain for a while when Nancy Lieberman was coaching Martina, because she, at that stage in the early 80s, she felt that Martina had to dislike all her opponents, including Chrissy, that was the only way she would get the best out of herself competitively. But that was short-lived, and they moved past that without any doubts, and they remain good friends to this day. And yes, they have. It's true about the health issues, and they both have battled cancer, and they're healthy now, and they're here now, and it's great to see it. You're right.
Hall of Fame Steve Flink. That must have been a super memory for you, just getting inducted into the Hall of Fame yourself up in Newport.
It was, and it was hard for me to believe. It was actually 8 years ago, 2017. But also, I was speaking of Chrissy. I was lucky enough that she agreed to be my presenter. Because I'd been sort of known as her Boswell, the person that sort of knew the most about her career, yeah. and I'd chronicled it so closely, and then we also became friends over time. So she came and spoke for me, which was really very gratifying. I'll always remember that year.
Unbelievable. Well, you are certainly a treasure, and I say that in just the most positive, of ways. Thanks so much for joining us on Sports Interview, and continued success, and keep it going, Steve Flink. It's always great to see you.
Great to see you, Ann, and you're very good at what you do. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much. My thanks to Amelie Fung and her younger sister, Alexa Fung, to Steve Flink, and to my good self in production. As George Bernard Shaw once said, life is not about finding yourself. Life is about creating yourself. Have a great week. Be safe. Be kind. And I look forward to visiting with you again next time on Sports Interview with Ann McGorry.